Okay. Let's get going. So I'll do one more circularly polarized example. And then I want to calculate the pointing flux associated I'll be saying pointing flux a lot, okay? That means pointing vector. And time average pointing flux associated with a circularly polarized wave. As we are doing that, we'll see some manipulations which are going to be helpful in completing your homework problems to your Piper plot today if you haven't already done so. And then we will talk about propagation in conducting or lossy media. Those are more or less the plans for the day. Okay, so let's start with this. We have an electric field phaser, so we are viewing things now in phaser domain. Okay, I'll be doing this a lot, and I select y plus j z hat, and I have to have e to the plus or minus j beta x. And it's no longer possible to use x or y. So let's say plus j beta x. What do we have here? We have the phasor of a circular polarized wave that's propagating in minus z direction. That's what we have. Okay? Let's determine whether this is right or left circular. Now, I know that some people were missing last lecture, and they are now here, and they're saying, what is this guy talking about? Well, you missed some stuff, okay? We're talking about phasor notation and circular polarized waves, and you can catch up from the notes, but it makes sense that we talk about phasors if you're talking about cosinusoidal varying quantities. So if an electric field is changing in time with a given frequency in a cosinusoidal manner, omega, and if we are in free space, there is going to be a corresponding beta such that omega over beta is equal to c. If we are in free space or otherwise, we are in some other type of a dielectric, it is like this. The dielectrics have to be lossless. There should be no conductivity because that's something that we haven't looked at yet. But these are the facts. For every frequency omega, there is a corresponding beta. And then depending on which direction you are propagating, you're going to have waveforms that are of the type cosine omega t plus or minus beta z, if z or minus z is the propagation direction. And when you turn that into phasors, that's you are applying the rules of ECE 210. Any cosinusoidal signal can be associated with a complex quantity such that e to the j omega t times that complex quantity. Real part gives you the cosine function that you have. That's a summary of what we did. Okay, so, and then we also pointed out that everything that we did until yesterday was dealing with linear depolarized fields and waves, and now we are constructing circularly polarized ones for reasons that we gave. These are important in certain applications, and therefore we should learn what they are. So here is a circularly polarized field, and is this right or left circular? So now I say that there is a J here, therefore the Z component is leading the Y component. That's what I say. If that is the case, that means that the Z component first peaks and then the Y component peaks after that, okay? Which means that if the if you want to envision this vector to be rotating around, it is rotating from the Z axis towards the Y axis because it first visits the Z axis and a quarter period later on it visits the Y axis. So to make a picture of that, this is my X, Y, and Z coordinates. The propagation is in minus x direction, so I can put a wiggly arrow saying this is the way I'm propagating. And then from this analysis that z component leads the y component, I decide that the arrow is rotating from z towards y. So at some instance, it is pointing in this direction, and then it will then move into this direction. Quarter period later, it will be aligned with y. That's the rotation sense. So I have my rotation sense. So that is a vector that is rotating around on the yz axis associated with a field that's propagating minus x axis. And is this right hand?
Yes,
it is right hand. Right hand circular. Okay, so this lead lag stuff is, yeah? Yes?
Oh, no.
Okay. So these perspective things are always, you know, if you look at it wrong way in your brain, you know, it gives you the wrong impression. So in a sense, you should just do this without even drawing those pictures. That's the way things are. So because, you know, John, I don't know whether you are thinking of this arrow sticking into the blackboard or coming out. That is the perspective thing. I am thinking of that sticking into the blackboard, and then it's all okay. All right. So, if you're not used to yet to this leading lagging type of arguments, you want to check this through the usual going to time domain. Corresponding to this function of x. There is a function, a vector function of both x and t, and that is the real part of this thing, which only depends on x, times e to the j omega t. Okay? And when you do that, this omega t combines with this j beta x to be a e to the j omega t plus beta x. And when I take the real part, I use Euler's identity. And when I use Euler's identity in this case, I'm going to have, for the y component, cosine of omega t plus beta z. And then for the z component, I'm going to have plus z. And that's going to be, well, it's going to be j times sine omega t, but it's multiplying j. So I have j squared. J squared is minus 1. So I shouldn't really put a plus sign here. I should put a minus sign here. Minus sine omega t plus beta z. Okay? So this is in the time domain, the same function. And you see how much it is easier, more economic to use this notation rather than this notation because it takes less blackboard space. And if you now want to inspect the right or left-handedness, you examine this equation. Okay? For the exercise that you go through is as follows. You select some z value. It doesn't matter which z value. The easiest one is to select z equals 0. It's z, not z, x. Everybody is frowning, and that's because I made a mistake. These are all x's. Sorry. Okay? So then the easiest thing is to take x equal to 0. That place you to a location at the origin. At the origin, you're going to examine how in time this vector is rotating around. So this goes away and this goes away. And then at t equals 0, this guy is dead, but this guy is alive. This guy is 1. At t equals 0, evidently, we have our vector pointing in y direction. This is t equals 0. But what happens shortly after t equals 0? Shortly after t equals 0, this guy shrinks, and the z component that used to be 0 is no longer 0. Okay, it grows to some small positive quantity, but there is a minus sign in front of that, so there is a little vector pointing in minus z direction. So our arrow representing the electric field at t equals 0 rotates downwards in this way, in the same direction that I concluded earlier on. Okay, it is still right-handed, one way or the other. Any questions here? And then this lead-lag business should be viewed in the complex plane, okay? In the complex plane with the real and imaginary axis, I can represent every complex number as a dot in that complex plane, and I have two numbers to represent here. Basically, I have the number that corresponds to E sub y. There is an implied E sub y, and that is equal to 1. And then here is an implied E sub z, that is j. Okay, and this is E sub z. And both of them can be placed on the complex plane. And on the complex plane, E sub z is here, is the number j, and that's E sub z. And the other one is E sub y, which is 1. Okay? This is E sub y. And associated with each of these complex numbers, there is an angle. Okay? Complex numbers are either characterized by their real and imaginary components, or via their magnitudes and angle that they make with respect to the real axis. They both have the same magnitude of 1. One has an angle of 0, the other has an angle of 90 degrees. The one that has 90 degrees is leading the other one in angle by 90 degrees. Okay? So this is the angle of E sub z, which is greater than the angle of E sub y, which is equal to 0. And this means that the leading thing, so we sort of like say, so what? Well, when we multiply these two complex numbers with e to the j omega t and take the real part, what we are doing is, as time increases, we are changing the locations of these arrows on the complex plane and then take their projections onto the real axis, okay? So, and with time increasing, e to the j omega t takes these points and start rotating in this direction. This is the phasor rotation idea that you probably heard a little bit about in ECE210, okay? So that means that some time ago, quarter a period ago, this dot was here and this dot was there. So when this dot was here at that instant, okay, we have the z component peaking, okay? Because it's always you take the real part. So always the projection of those rotating arrows at rotating positions, complex numbers, onto the real axis that shows the instantaneous magnitude associated with that component. So I can see that a while back, quarter of a period ago, this leading guy was here and the lagging guy was there. and the peak was associated with E sub C. Okay? And then as time progresses, E sub C peak shrinks and E sub Y peak comes up. But clearly, this picture is showing that first E sub C peaks and then E sub Y. So therefore, the rotation is the way we have pictured here. Any questions here? So this is supposed to be sort of like discussed in ECE 210 or courses just like that, but there's usually an overkill of so many subjects in 210, so we sort of like skip it and leave this discussion to be done and completed in this course. This is a required course, so you might as well do it at this stage. Any questions here? All right, so now this is our electric field. It's in volts per meter. Phasor units are the same as the time domain units. Phasors inherit the units from the time domain. What is the corresponding H? To get the corresponding H phasor, basically I'm going to do several things. I'm going to divide this phasor by eta. Then I'm going to look each of the linearly polarized components of that and do my right-hand rule to make associations that are appropriate for the H. And then when I combine them, I will pay respect to the weightings that they have, okay? This guy has a weighting 1, this guy has a weighting J, and that J weighting is also going to be applicable in the second part of the H expression, okay? So, if paying attention with the Y, okay, I ask myself, what should be the corresponding H so that right-hand rule is compatible with propagation in minus X direction? This Y component, this linear component of this circular polarized wave has an accompanying H, and that should be, it looks like it has to be pointing in minus Z direction, isn't it? You were just doing that. So I have to have a minus Z that is showing up for the first component, and then I have to add to this J times whatever is the accompaniment for Z. When the electric field is pointing in the Z direction, the corresponding H has to be, you tell it.
Y,
exactly. So that is it. So that's correct. And then I should divide by eta, otherwise I'm off. And what else? And then I should have my e to the plus j beta x. I'm completed, and this is in amperes per meter. Okay? Now you ask, is this right-handed or left-handed? Because this also represents a vector, now vector h that is rotating around just at the same rate accompanying the rotating vector. At each instant, it is perpendicular to the electric field vector. And if that's to remain, it should also be right-handed. Otherwise, they would sort of like collide at some point. They would point instantaneously in the same direction. So they are just rotating in the same sense. And we should be able to see that by looking at the implied H sub Z and H sub Y. Okay? This time, which one is leading what? Now, minus 1 is leading plus J. Minus 1 is leading plus J, and for that, we can go still to the complex plane and put minus 1 here and plus J here, and the angle of this guy is greater than the angle of this guy. So this is H sub Z minus 1. This is the real and imaginary axis. And this J is H sub Y. This is telling me that at t equals 0, my H field in the Z direction peaks, except that it peaks in the negative direction, negative. You know, cosine function will go plus and minus. It's going through its negative peak, okay? While this guy is going through its zero. So quarter period later, while H sub Z travels to be nothing, E sub H sub Y will peak. But it is clearly first H sub Z is peaking, then H sub Y. So then the picture is once again, rotation from Z direction towards Y direction is right-handed. Okay? So this is the sort of things that you should be able to do in the long run. Any questions? So now let's calculate the pointing flux. So we have a minus X propagating right circular polarized wave. Now this, of course, the fact that this is right circular or left, the fact that this is circular is coming about because of two things. The amplitudes of the two orthogonal components are the same, okay? If one was 1, the other was 2, we wouldn't have a circular polarized wave. We would have an elliptically polarized wave. The other thing that it is a 90 degree phase shift combined with the previous fact. All of these conspire to make this a circular polarized wave. Okay, so for instance, we had the two same magnitudes for the X and Y components, but if the phase difference was not 90 degrees, but 45 degrees, again, this would not be a circularly polarized. Again, it would be elliptically polarized. waves are either circularly polarized or linearly polarized, and these are both special cases. Otherwise, they are elliptically polarized. And it is easy to see and recognize circular and linear polarized waves, and just check it. If it's not, you know it's elliptical. But we are not going to stress elliptical polarization in any straightforward way. But we want to calculate the average power that is carried by this thing. That means that there is an associated S, and that is going to be time and space varying vector, okay? Because it is time varying in a periodic fashion, I'm interested in its time average. And that refers, of course, to the time average of E cross H, because S is E cross H. Although, what are these E's and H's? The E's and H's are what we would get. This is the E, okay? And there is a corresponding H. I haven't even written down that H, and I don't need to write that down, because I can do this calculation in the phasor domain. And that goes that time average E cross H is always is 1/2 the real part of the E phasor cross H phasor conjugate. So this is a rule, okay? We typically are declaring things now in the phasor domain. We will make our calculation in the phasor domain. All right, so let's just go ahead. So that is going to be then 1/2 the real part. Now I have to copy everything I have over there correctly. Y plus jz times e to the plus j beta x. That is cross multiply. That is important. This is not just ordinary multiplication. Vector cross multiplication with h. And for h, we evidently have eta divides everything. We have minus z, then plus jy, and we have e to the plus j beta x. Except that this whole factor has to be conjugated, which means that the sign of plus j beta x has to be turned into minus j beta x, and this j also should be replaced by minus j theta, so I have this guy. Okay, and then I continue. Eta is a quantity that is sitting there, it's a real number, so I can put this here, so I don't need to deal with denominators anymore. And then I say the following. This guy will cross multiply this, and that will be y cross into minus z hat. That certainly is going to be either plus or minus x, and we'll figure it out. I think it's going to be minus x because the entire field is propagating in minus x direction, and energy carrier should be in that direction. And what else? But when I do that cross multiplication, I have to multiply these two guys together as well. But those guys sort of kiss and kill one another. They become one. All right, so I don't have to put anything there. And then I should cross multiply this guy into this guy. Thank God, that goes to zero. When I cross multiply a vector by itself, that's zero. Cross multiplication likes orthogonal things. Dot multiplication likes parallel things. Cross multiplication likes orthogonal things. So that doesn't contribute. And then this guy doesn't contribute, but then the final guy contributes. So in that one too, we have an exponential multiplying its conjugate is annihilating one another. What is left, evidently, let's just be careful here. I have j and minus j. And when I multiply j and minus j, I get 1. So I have to add, don't subtract. Okay, and what do I have? It is z cross y. Close bracket. Now, this guy is the same as this guy. Although there is a minus sign, I can get rid of that minus sign by flopping this around. And I am going to have contribution coming to this, adding to the contribution coming to this. Z cross y, if we go to our equation, is pointing in minus x direction. Okay? So this is a unit vector in minus x direction. So is this. Any questions? So then, before I add them up, I'm going to have twice minus x hat. Before I add them up, I make a mental note that I am having my total power density associated with my circular polarized wave coming as a sum of two terms. I can now trace back these two terms to two linearly polarized waves. My original construction of the circularly polarized waves was in terms of linearly polarized waves. My circularly polarized wave is nothing but a special linear combo of two orthogonal linearly polarized waves. And my final result for the average power is sort of remembering that. One is coming from one of those linear ways, the other is coming from the other linear way. And they are equal. They are equal because they have the same amplitude. Any questions here? And then, let's just write down the result. I have negative 2 x hat. That 2 is going to cancel this guy. I'm going to have negative 1 over eta x hat. That negative sign is showing that the energy is propagating in minus x direction, as the exponent of the phasor is already indicating. There is nothing new there. And it is comforting that all these things work out correctly. Any questions? So then, you remember the following. A circular polarized wave, which is always can always be thought about to be a summation, superposition of two linearly polarized waves, contains twice the power that each of its linear components has. Okay? Its power content is larger. Why is that? It's very easy. Circular polarized wave is an E field that is rotating, never going through zero. Its two components are doing this and going through zero. Each of these have half the content. This guy has twice the content. Any questions? Okay, and when I'm making this comparison, saying that circular polarized wave has twice the pointing flux of the its component linearly pointing linearly polarized components, I am well aware that the peak amplitudes of the three waves that I'm talking about are identical. The peak amplitudes of the circular polarized wave never changes. It is whatever the radius of that vector is. The peak amplitude of the linearly polarized waves is whenever the linearly polarized wave goes through its plus and minus peaks as it's oscillating between the two extrema. Okay? So I am comparing apples and apples in this sense. I am now comparing two wave fields, one linearly polarized, one circularly polarized. They both have the same peak amplitude. Let us say one. Okay? This guy has a unity peak amplitude. At t equals zero, its electric field is pointing in this direction and it has unity amplitude. At all other times, it's still unity. Its component, two component cosinusoidals also have peak amplitude of one. Okay? So I am therefore talking about same peak amplitude guys, and when I compare at same peak amplitude, and be careful about this. In an exam, I will ask probably a question similar to this, and there will be a lot of wrong answers. Okay? And I will comment about this a little bit further. Alright? So, same peak amplitudes, it means that the circular polarized wave has twice the energy content. Any questions? So, if you have an electric field phasor just like this, okay, you may be tempted to numerically associate the word amplitude with the square root of E dot E star. Okay? If you do that for the linearly polarized wave, you get a number that is exactly what you mean by the amplitude, the peak value. But if you do that for the circularly polarized wave, you don't get that. What do you get? Please look at this and tell me what you're going to get. So I am saying that suppose you calculate E phasor dot E phasor conjugate. I am conjugating because I don't want to mess around with the phase term. I want the phase term to go away. Okay? And then, of course, this is E squared. It wouldn't be amplitude, it will be power-like. And I'm going to take the square root of this. Okay? If I do that, for instance, for not the circularly polarized wave, but just this way, I'm going to get 1. But for the circular polarized wave, what am I going to get? Sam? Do it. Exactly. Okay? So this is going to give the amplitude for linearly polarized wave, but it is going to give square root 2 times the amplitude for the circularly polarized wave. Okay? And then, if you really think about it, by the time you calculate the pointing flux, time average pointing flux, by going 1/2 real part of E cross H, that is nothing other than E dot E star divided by 2 eta naught, because H is fixed into E through the eta relationship and the 90 degree relationship. By the time you cross-multiply two vectors that are orthogonal to one another, whose magnitude differs just by eta, you get a number that is the E dot E divided by eta. That's you get. You get E dot E star, to be specific, because you want also the phase term to disappear. Okay? So, in some sense, you know, instead of doing it this way, we could have used it this way. We could have said the average pointing flux is E dot E star divided by 2 eta. The same situation would have been okay. And this is useful to know, because if in the exam I say, get me the pointing flux, if you don't know this, if you have H, if you have E but no H, okay, you would have to first calculate H and then do, whereas if you can direct it from E, okay? So that is useful to know. And now, the fact that that is the pointing flux, and the fact that there is an additional square root of 2 factor for the circular polarized guy, accounts for why you're going to have twice the amount of power when you calculate the power associated, the point associated with the circular polarized guy. Anyway, these are a little bit of details. You should do it however way you want to do it. If you want to do it long way, do it the long way. But after some exercises, you will figure out the best approaches to use at various situations. Any questions? Okay, so I'm closing this subject, moving on with the next subject. Next, I want to talk about how these plane waves propagate in media where sigma is not equal to zero. In other words, there is going to be currents. Already we know that we should be making distinctions between source currents and the load currents. All right? We know that from our current sheet example, that current sheet, when it radiates, it generates an adjacent electric field. In fact, a co-located electric field that is pointing against the current direction, because that's a source situation. But in load situations, there's going to be currents and electric fields that are parallel to one another. And all that stuff is not inconsistent with our notions from circuit theory, too, in that when we have a very simple circuit like this, a current source feeding some resistor, let's say this is 2 amperes, 3 ohms, then there is going to be a 6 volt, and that 6 volt is going to be in the direction of the current through the element, which is the load, but that 6 ohm is against the very same 6 load. That 6 volt is not only true for this guy, but also for this guy. All right, so these are parallel, they enjoy the same voltage. So the voltage-current relationships are different in the load and the source region. That's exactly what we saw. We're going to see now how having loads in the places where the fields are propagating are going to have an effect on how the fields are propagating. That's what we want to study over the next 2 days or so. Before we get into that, I want to have a discussion. The wave stuff that we learned so far, before we generalize into these conducting lossy media, do you guys think everything we did and learned so far is applicable only in those regions where epsilon and mu are constants in space, or is it still okay if the epsilon and mu of the medium is changing as a function of position and still retain the results that we have obtained so far? What do you guys think? Let's have a little discussion. You guys are kind of human, you should be listening. Okay, so let's have this discussion. Any propositions? And let's put a name, homogeneous versus inhomogeneous medium. By homogeneous medium, we mean that mu and epsilon are independent of position. Do we need homogeneous medium in order to justify everything we did, or inhomogeneous media are okay or not? Come on, somebody say something, and not Jim. You, Alex, you always have opinions. The answer is not surprising, it is what you're feeling, probably. It's not risky. Do we need homogeneity or not?
No.
No, you're wrong. We need homogeneity. When it is inhomogeneous, things become more complicated, okay? Some of which we will see in this class, but most of it is seen actually in other classes, okay? Now, you're wrong, but it is good to see where this thing was coming. If it is inhomogeneous, I mean that either epsilon or mu or both are changing as a function of position. If they were changing as a function of position, some of the steps that we took in deriving the wave equation and coming with D'Alembert solution, etc., would be unjustified and wrong. I want to identify where those points are, and then we want to move on. Yes?
It's similar to, like, we can't use Poisson's and Laplace's.
In some sense, yes, because of derivatives. Certain derivatives have to be applied to epsilon and mu as well, but we didn't do such derivatives. We pulled them out from the derivatives. That's why. But where were they? We have to go back to Maxwell's equations, right? In deriving the wave equation, we had a divergence of B is equal to rho, but we set rho equal to zero because we are source free. Okay? We also have a divergence of B equal zero absolutely. And then we have a divergence of E, which is minus dB dt. And we wrote it as, we don't want to deal with B. And this B we can write as H, perhaps, okay? Because it is zero, it doesn't matter. And this, we wrote minus mu dH dt. And what was the final equation? Curl of E is equal to, curl of H is equal to J plus dB dt. So where did we go wrong? Where would we go wrong if the medium is inhomogeneous? So when we go del cross E, all right, we would have to curl this side. And in curling that side, we cannot just say that is mu times ddt of curl of H. We would have to apply some derivatives onto mu as well, because mu is depending in position. So that very step there allows you not to have mu changing as a function of position. The other thing that we use is we expanded del cross E as gradient of divergence of E minus the Laplacian of, Laplacian is the squared del, obviously, of E, and we ignore del dot E. And why did we ignore del dot E? Because divergence of D is equal to zero. But divergence of D equal to zero would not necessarily imply divergence of E is equal to zero if epsilon, this D is epsilon E, was a function of position. It is because of those two things, okay, our wave equation would not have been correct. And indeed, when electromagnetic waves propagate in regions where epsilon and or mu are changing as a function of position, it's a more difficult problem. That's called a refraction-reflection problem, okay? If the change is happening continuously and very slowly, there is ray tracing techniques which are relatively easy to apply and to learn, okay? So that you will see perhaps in, if you take courses like 452, you will see that to a certain extent. Even we will touch upon maybe in 350 a little bit. Okay, and there is another situation which is even easier. It is inhomogeneous, but as Alex is remembering, it's a Poisson-like situation. Although it's inhomogeneous, it is distinct regions which are homogeneous adjacent to one another. You can then use boundary conditions and you solve the problems that way. That we're going to do in this class. And then there is a final case in which there is a spatial variation, and that spatial variation is happening very fast spatially. It is happening faster than the wavelength that is appropriate for a given frequency. And then it becomes a very messy. Even ray tracing is not the right approach. You have to do the full wave solution, so to speak, of the Maxwell's equations numerically. Okay? So, now, I want to stay in homogeneous media, but I want to place a sigma in it, so that we have a lossiness. So that when the electric field is accompanied by H, it is also accompanied by a J, because every time this E sees the local homogeneous conductivity of some finite size, it is going to create a current flow, and that is going to have its effect. And we know that it's going to lead to lossiness because currents waste energy. Currents bang. By sigma, that is real and positive, we imply that there is an underlying ohmic process, and that underlying ohmic process is something that we describe with Newton's law. There is things banging around. The accelerated electrons bang into the lattice, therefore there is energy transfer from the field into heating the medium. That means the field amplitude is going to decay. All that stuff is going to come into the picture. Any questions here? Now, yes?
In a lossy homogeneous medium, will the energy decay exponentially or linearly?
Let's see that. That is going to be related to the Poynting flux. Poynting flux is going to give you the answer. First of all, it depends how is the amplitude of the electric field changing. We're going to see that. And that is going to be then reflected, as you may expect, because E and H are going to follow one another in some fashion, although their relationship is a little bit more complicated because there are phase shifts, and then we will find it out from there. Okay? So let's step by step discover all those things. Now, this is also a time where it is important to realize that we are taking matter in more serious ways into account, and there is going to be a frequency dependent. Okay? This is where we are going to start encountering responses that depend on whether your frequencies are high or low, etc. So given that, D'Alembert solution is not going to work anymore. D'Alembert solution was very special. You know, it was the transmission of an identical input signal all the way to the other side with no distortion. That's not going to happen. And if that's not going to happen, we have to find ourselves in the frequency domain. We should not be working in the time domain. Time domain is the wrong way. In fact, when we say D is equal to epsilon, D is equal to epsilon times electric field, and we think of ourselves doing this in the time domain, we are actually not being very truthful. This is only true approximately, and I want to get to that in a few moments. There are a few other things that I wanted to look into. Okay, so let's continue. Let's continue as follows. So, for the moment, I will say I'm interested in scenarios in which there are only time-varying fields that are propagating to a region. I'm not going to concern myself with the production or radiation issue. No more surface sheets to justify why a field is there. I assume that there is some radiator out there. It has generated its radiation. Now that radiation is passing through a region where there is some conductivity. Okay, so get used to that. Okay? There are sources of radiation, and then there are places to propagate to. If that place to propagate through is inhomogeneous, you have to do ray tracing. Okay? If that region has conductivity, you have to take that conductivity into account. So we are in such a problem, and our incoming field is cosinusoidal, so we make this a simple problem. If it is more complicated, still you can break that more complicated thing into sinusoidal components, solve the solution for sinusoidal component, and then synthesize. That's what Fourier synthesis is. So given that, first, I want to reinterpret my Maxwell's equation in a slightly different way. All right? So divergence of D is equal to rho. That's fine. Divergence of B is equal to zero. That is also fine. Okay? And then divergence of E is equal to minus dB dt. Okay? So if I have a cosinusoidally changing B, I can represent it in terms of its phasors. And in one of the properties that we learn in about phasors from 210 is that time derivatives become j omegas if we are dealing with phasors. So let me then turn all these relationships into phasors. I have a phasor D, phasor rho, phasor B, phasor E. And the curl of phasor E is equal to minus dB dt, no, minus j omega B. And I'm going to say mu h. Okay? I'm in the frequency domain. This mu can actually be a frequency-dependent frequency response, just like we discussed some time ago. So then B equal mu h written in the frequency domain makes sense if omega is a function of, mu is a function of omega. I have a product in the frequency domain. If I were to translate that product into time domain, what should I do? Convolution, somebody says. Right. Multiplication in frequency domain has a convolution in the time domain. There should be some inverse Fourier transform of all these quantities in the time domain, maybe h of t, e of t, and mu of t, and they should be convolved. Mu of t convolved with, which one? Mu of t convolved with h of t gives you b of t. Okay, that's so weird that we don't do that usually. That's why we cheat and said b is equal to mu times h until this point where I'm making this clear. So being in the frequency domain is the fundamentally the correct range regime. Because when we do also, when we do our basic relationship for epsilon by solving for the susceptibility, going using Maxwell's equations, Drude model, etc., we do this in the frequency domain. We really get a model for epsilon in the frequency domain, and we can correctly say that in the frequency domain, the phasor or the Fourier transform D is a certain function of omega that we call epsilon times the Fourier transform of electric field. That is an absolutely correct statement. And nothing to question. If you're going to go back to time domain, you need a convolution. We didn't do that. We were lazy. Okay? So now, since we're going to be in frequency domain, we are going to be doing things right. All right. So one more. Okay. Curl of H. That is, and curl of H phasor is equal to J phasor. And that then we have d dt of displacement. Right? Displacement is epsilon times electric field. In the frequency domain, I can absolutely do that, okay? And I'm going to say that we are going to have J omega epsilon times the electric field. Any questions here? So I'm also making my epsilon not to be time dependent. Otherwise, I would have to deal with that as an issue, okay? Epsilon is a frequency dependent quantity, but it is not a time dependent. At every place, it is not only independent of position, but it is also independent of time. But there is one such constant epsilon that is appropriate for different frequencies. Any questions here? Those are frequency responses. So these are the equations that I want to deal with. Okay, so if I want to then, and then what is new? What is new is going to be, I'm going to say, in the problem I'm next solving, my J is going to be sigma times E. So let me collect all these equations together now. These are important equations. First, D phasor is epsilon times electric field phasor. All right? These are known as constitutive relations. These are relations that are related to the constitution of the material or the medium in which we are propagating. So material relation or constitutive relations. B tilde is mu times H tilde. And finally, J tilde is equal to sigma times E. And I'm going to assume that my sigma, just like the rest, is a number per different frequency, but it is constant of position and time and all that. All right, so that's the setting in which I'm going to solve these equations. Any questions here? Now, I am also going to set rho equal to 0, but not J equal to 0. Now, can I do that? Well, what should we look at? Continuity equation. Let's see, look at the continuity equation allows us to do that. The reason why I'm going to set rho equal to 0 and J not equal to 0 is by rho equal to 0, I make my divergence of E equal to 0, and I remain in the realm of the transverse electromagnetic waves that we have seen. Okay? In reality, in material media with conductivity, you can also have longitudinal waves in addition to transverse waves, but you can study the longitudinal waves and transverse waves one at a time. Because of the linearity of the system, superposition is allowed, and you can say, hey, I'm going to study only those waves where rho is equal to 0. After you are done, you have all this knowledge you put summarized in a page, and then you start the next day another page. Now I'm not going to assume my rho is equal to 0. I will get the properties of additional type of solutions that Maxwell's equations support. After I solve that, then I will have two different modes that can exist, and I can then consider their superposition as appropriate. For now, I'm going to ask myself what is going to be the properties of the waves if rho is equal to 0. If rho is equal to 0, divergence of J has to be equal to 0. If divergence of J is equal to 0, and if J is equal to sigma E, and if sigma is a constant, then divergence of E has to be equal to 0. If divergence of E is equal to 0, I am okay setting this equation to 0. I've just gone around full circle and told you why it is okay. All right, now I have to put it on the blackboard before I forget. Did you follow? All right, so d rho dt plus divergence of J is always equal to 0. This is, in the time domain, the continuity equation. If you go into phasor domain, this equation becomes J omega rho phasor plus divergence of J tilde phasor is equal to 0. Okay? If I am imposing, or if I'm choosing only to study those cases in which rho is equal to 0, I set this guy to 0, then I have necessarily have to have divergence of J is equal to 0. If that divergence of J is equal to 0, I should then take the divergence of this equation, divergence of J, which is equal to 0, is also equal to the divergence of sigma times E, but sigma is a constant, it can come out of the divergence operation, then it can be like this, and this to be true while sigma is not true requires divergence of E to be equal to 0, and that's no problem with this. Okay? So I can study those waves that are generating non-divergent currents while transverse electromagnetic waves, which are non-divergent electric fields, are propagating through. It's just that these currents are parallel to the electric field and they have no divergence. Okay, they accompany. They're going to be sort of transverse currents, basically. They are not going to be longitudinal currents. If you have longitudinal currents, then the divergence of J would not be equal to 0, and it would generate the kind of plasma waves that one sees. Anybody working in Professor Park or Professor Eden's lab, there's always students doing research there. You guys there deal with plasmas there, and they can generate space charge waves of that type. Okay. Also in my work, when I study the ionosphere is full of longitudinal waves. They are sound wave-like waves. They are compression waves. In addition to electromagnetic waves, those sound-like waves travel slowly. They travel with sound-like speeds. These TM guys travel at the speed of light, which is why they are so good. You know, we don't wait for them. They come fast. Okay, any questions here? So I'm going to proceed. I'm going to set this guy zero. So divergence of B is equal to zero. Divergence of E is equal to, might as well at this point write this divergence of E as equal to zero. We are justified to do all that because we are working in homogeneous media. Okay, now you are a little bit more sensitive when we can do that and we cannot. And let's move on. Okay? I'm going to move on basically by looking at the curl equation more than anything else. Okay? Let me write those curl equations once for completeness on this side. Curl of E is equal to minus j omega mu h. And the other guy is as follows. Curl of h. Now I'm going to do my substitution. I declare some existence of some conductivity. This is a load region. Sigma times E is my current. And the other term has also current in it. I can write this in various ways. I can write it like this. Sigma plus j omega epsilon times E. That's another way of writing this. Or even better, I can write this as follows. Let me pull j omega out from this and write j omega out in the front. Then in parentheses, I have epsilon plus sigma over j omega. This is still true. Okay? So if I am in a situation where there is no sigma, of course, I have only j omega epsilon, and I reach into some results, some conclusions. I have a dispersion relation in which speed turns out to be 1 over square root of mu epsilon. And I have an intrinsic impedance, which is square root of mu over epsilon. Both of these expressions has epsilon in them for the lossless medium. Now, if I take the very same formula, later on replace those epsilons by epsilon plus sigma over j omega, from my old equations, I regain new equations that are applicable in situations where sigma is not equal to zero. So that is why it is valuable to give some name to this combo. Epsilon plus sigma over j omega, we can, for the moment, call epsilon tilde and think of it as an effective epsilon, okay? So if you want to analyze what's going on in conducting regions, just go to the theory of plane waves in the frequency domain for non-conducting regions and replace all the epsilons with epsilon tildes. That's the name of the game. Any questions? Okay, so now, let us now combine these equations in some fashion. Let's do a repeat. We already know the results of sigma equal to zero. We got them in the time domain, but let's get from the frequency domain equations here. And then we will change all the epsilons into epsilon tildes, and then we'll be done. One more thing I want to say. This phase, these are the frequency domain form of these Maxwell's equations. The way I got them was by using the phasor transformation idea, okay? But I could have equally well said that I have these four equations in space and time. If I were to take the Fourier transform, each of these equations on both sides, I would exactly end up with the same equations. Then I would not be calling this guy the phasor, I would be calling this the Fourier transform. But the form of the equations would have been the same. Now, if I have a phasor or a Fourier transform, the way I go back into time domain is slightly different. To go with the Fourier transform into time domain, what do I take? Inverse Fourier transform involves the Fourier transform and e to the j omega t a certain integral. You multiply all that with d omega divided by 2 pi and take the integral, you go back into the time domain. Okay? And that integral is two-sided. It has positive frequencies and minus frequencies. You go from minus infinity to plus infinity. How do you go from the phasor into the time domain? Now, of course, Fourier transform applies to all sorts of signals, okay? Phases only apply to individual cosinusoids, so they are different in that sense. But their equations are the same in the Maxwell sense. How do you take a phasor back into the time domain?
Can you do it
You multiply with e to the j omega t and take, say, the real part. Does that resemble, in some sense, inverse Fourier transformation? In some sense, it does. Because taking the real part operation is also equivalent to taking that thing plus cc divided by 2. Brian, remember cc?
Yes.
So, when you have your phasor times e to the j omega c plus cc divided by 2, and that gives you the time domain, that is sort of like the Fourier transformation, in inverse Fourier transform integral, because there is a positive frequency one, negative frequency one. That cc part contains, instead of e to the plus j omega t, it has e to the minus j omega t. So it's exactly the same thing in a sense, okay? So from now on, really, really, you know, appreciate the stuff that you learn in ECE 210, that the world of phasors and the world of Fourier transform are so intrinsically related that we feel confident to talk about both of them under one breath. Okay? We take the phasor transform, get sort of equations like this, then interpret them as Fourier transform. It doesn't matter. When I go to back to time domain, I'll decide whether to do an inverse phasor transformation or inverse Fourier transform. If I have many components, I will do it as a Fourier transformation. If I have a single cosinusoid, I'm going to do it as, obviously, as a phasor transform. Did I run out of time?
Yeah.
Okay, so, all right, so let's finish this. Is it tomorrow or?
No.
All right, thanks.